Joel, this woman has created a nightmare for herself. She might as well have given them the best gift on the planet, wrapped it up in fancy paper and sent it on to them, because what she did was just open up a world of trouble.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation, and welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor, the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in all of true crime, and you're in for a treat today with at least one new face. We are talking about the twisted tale of a mom of three allegedly murdering her husband, then profiting from a children's book off of his likeness about grief. Of course, we are talking about Utah mom Corey Richens. She stands accused, as I just mentioned, of poisoning husband Eric by spiking his celebratory Moscow Mule cocktail with five times the lethal dose of fentanyl. Here to discuss the very latest, the new face. A lot of people know her. Best guest, Court TV anchor Julie Grant. She is an award-winning journalist. She's also a licensed attorney, a former prosecutor, and trial expert. Her Court TV colleagues call her the professor, and it's not with her glasses. Taught in Temple's highly regarded LLM program, and she is on the ball. You can watch Julie Grant host Court TV weekdays. I believe it is 12 to 3 p.m. Eastern time. Am I right about the time, Julie?
You know, we just switched it. And okay. Do you know what? It's not even up to date everywhere on our website. But yeah, now it's 8 a.m. But Joel, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. Big fan of your work. Love the podcast. It's awesome. So glad to be with you today.
And we are psyched to have you in the best guest roster. Next up, in the green shirt, trying to challenge me in my green, Monica Jordan. She is president of Jordan Research and Consulting, one of the nation's most sought-after private investigators. She's handled more than 50 death penalty trials, cases. She's worked with a notorious female serial killer, Eileen Wuornos, with her post-conviction team. Of course, the movie Monster was made about Eileen Wuornos, starring Charlize Theron. But Monica Jordan is the real deal, working with the real person. And then we've got Susan Constantine, one of the nation's leading jury consultants. She's also a body language and communication expert. She is the owner of the Human Behavior Lab, where she does analysis of potential jurors, their body language, their voice, statements during voir dire, et cetera, et cetera. She knows it all. So without further ado, let's get into this here. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Julie asks, do you have a Facebook page? We sure do. Everything is Surviving the Survivor. Except Twitter. We are at Podcast STS. You can also support us at Patreon and on YouTube. Believe it or not, the merch store is open and people are grabbing mugs, a lot of mugs. So that's a good thing. Julie, I'm going to start with you. Corey Richens, what kind of traction is this getting over at Court TV? This is kind of the flip side of what we see a lot of times where the husband goes after the wife. This time, the wife is accused of murdering the husband and, by all things, fentanyl poisoning after she was unsuccessful the first time. Your overall view of this and how the viewers reacted to the story.
Yes, Joel, incredible traction. Not only just with our Court TV Courties, as we call them, our awesome viewers who are with us day in and day out, but in the true crime community, and largely for the reasons you've said, it's taken the true crime community by storm, so to speak, because here you have this family that looks to be perfect on the outside, you know, this pretty mom, a handsome husband, three beautiful kids, living a very privileged lifestyle, a lot of wealth in a beautiful area of Utah, the Park City area. They both have what seem to be blossoming careers. But of course, you know, below the surface, we have found out that his career was the one blossoming. He was the rich one, not her. And then, of course, when you find out he's dead and then she goes on to publish this book, she gets a world of sympathy. And then it's a big timeout from the government. Wait, wait, wait. The motive for the death was money, that this woman was actually in a world of financial trouble. And the only way her husband would be good to her would be dead. And so that's what the state is alleging here, that she needed money, she needed him dead, and she did it in the most cold, calculating, heartless way to poison this wonderful young man, this father of three, while he thought he was having a celebratory drink with her. So much to dig into on this one. I'm fascinated by it personally. So let's do it. I'm glad to be on your show today, Joel.
We are going to hop right in. We're going to get back to the motive, which you mentioned, which is one of the oldest in time, goes to money, they say. But Susan Constantine, to you, in Yiddish, there is a word, chutzpah. I won't say the word in English, but she's accused of murdering her husband and then goes on a Salt Lake local TV news show to promote her own children's book about grief. What's going on here from a psychological standpoint, from a behavior standpoint?
Well, from a behavior standpoint, she's trying to appear as innocent as she can. So, you know, it's really interesting to kind of get into the mind of a person like this. They're thinking, if I'm going to plot this out, how can I make this really believable? Well, of course, I'm going to write a book on grieving. You know, our children are grieving and daddy's in heaven. And how can we make him still part of our lives? And then she appears like the girl next door. So the girl next door, the hairstyle, the clothing, her appearance, she doesn't wear much makeup. She just looks very, she looks angelic in a lot of ways. So, you know, in my career, one thing I always say is you can never predict who a killer is going to be. They can be the person next door. They can be a priest. They can be Jerry Sandusky, and they can also be a woman just like her. They don't look like killers. They look like everyday people. They fit into society. They go under the radar. They're very likable, approachable, charismatic. They fit right in, and that is today's killer.
Hopefully, Monica Jordan, with that innocent, angelic face of hers, is not up to... no good, which I'm sure she's not. But Monica, so you're a private investigator. You're one of the best in the country, and you work for the defense oftentimes. What would you be doing here in this case if you were hired by Sky Lazara? We've had her on the show. She is currently the defense attorney representing Corey Richens. What kind of headache would this be for you? Because the evidence piling up against her doesn't look too good.
There are some real challenges in this case based on the evidence that's been presented, and the state attorney's office in Utah has presented in the detention brief a lot of the mounting evidence that is so problematic, being the text messages, the financial issues. I mean, when you're searching how to collect on insurance when you kill your husband, or how to hide fentanyl death. And those are problems when they find it on your computer. And then lo and behold, your husband ends up dead with a fentanyl overdose. The first thing that I would do in this case is from an investigative standpoint is there's claims throughout the media that the husband was changing the will and changing the trustee, but that new will hasn't been identified or located yet. So that would be very important to me. But also, if I'm so convinced that my spouse is trying to kill me, why aren't I out of the house? So is he so concerned that she's trying to kill him? Because I can promise you, if you've tried to poison me on Valentine's Day, I'm not going to be there on February 15th.
Well, we've had Greg Skordis on. He is the spokesperson for Eric Richens' family. Do have the best guests, I have to say. Julie Grant has some of the best guests too, but
and Susan Constantine is one of them.
Exactly,
one of my favorites.
But you know, in regards to that, Monica, he's flat out said, "Look, I had three young boys, and he just didn't. You know, he wasn't able to leave the boys. He just didn't want to do it. Is that not reason enough? Do you think there needs to be more than just that?"
It would be my initial source of investigation. I understand exactly that he was a strong proponent of keeping that family together, but I also think he could have probably petitioned the court if he was truly in fear that the wife was trying to kill him to protect those children from their mother. That would be my initial source of investigation, because like I said, there's so much to look at here that's mounting against her. I'd have to kind of do it in reverse to see the best, you know, potentially the best defense. But she's got, you know, she's got problems. Mm.
Well said. She's got problems. 99 problems. I am not T-Pain, to another rapper that I never heard of. For you, Julie, do you think the new financial case, which we're going to get into, involving Corey, will help the prosecution or Corey's defense? What's your take?
The prosecution, and I'll tell you why. Joel, this woman has created a nightmare for herself. She might as well have given them the best gift on the planet, wrapped it up in fancy paper and sent it on to them, and they can give her a big hug and a kiss now, because what she did was just open up a world of trouble, right? So in the criminal case, we know the state's saying the motive is money, that she was broke, because even though she seemed to be living this wealthy lifestyle, it was because of him. He was the rich one. He was the successful one. She was using his money to try to get this business where she would buy these big homes, flip them, but she was failing miserably at that business. And he knew she was reckless. He was, you know, cutting her off from the money, all of that. So now, in being so greedy from jail, in suing his estate and saying, my dead husband owes me money, essentially, she's just opened up herself and all the other witnesses to depositions. Because in civil cases, that's what happens. Everybody sits down. It's recorded just like this podcast. You get nice videotape, all that. It's very informal, and she's got to answer questions. And so now, as if she didn't cause enough trouble for herself in the previous statement she made and the television appearance that she did, now she's going to be deposed. All of the documents that her civil lawyer is going to file. And by the way, I can't understand why in the world any civil lawyer would say to her, this is a good idea. You know, shame on whoever did that, you know, because they know she's charged with murder. And so now they've just opened her up to a world of trouble where those prosecutors are just going to go look in that docket every day. If I was on the case, I'd just be peeking at that docket constantly, pulling whatever I could. And then I would bring it over into criminal court and nail her with it.
Yeah, it seems like some of the worst legal advice in the absolute world to give. I presume that the civil attorneys representing her are going to be different, obviously, than the criminal, but the criminal attorneys, like you said, they can just peek into the public record and take whatever they want for their own case, right?
Exactly, Joel. So once it becomes, just since she, that act of filing the suit just opened up this world of trouble. And as you know, his lawyers, you know, the lawyers representing his estate are not sitting quiet. His sisters, of course, they want justice for him. They love him. They've fired back with a countersuit. So now we've got two civil suits. We've got these, you know, counterclaims going separate and apart from the criminal case. And now these prosecutors, I mean, they must be jumping for joy, because if it was tough before, it's going to be even easier now because of her.
Shout out to Dom's mom. Good morning, STS fam. Shout out to my home state, New Jersey, Cool Chick 67. Hello, STS Nation, best guest. Lorna is a regular here, part of STS Nation. Hello, everyone. Followed by Debbie Blair. Hello, everyone. Susan, to you, back to motive, and then we'll get into some of these lawsuits. The state now says that they believe that Corey Richens killed her husband, Eric, over something very specific, over a $2 million mansion that she wanted to buy and flip. By the way, if you Google this mansion, for those who have not seen it, I live in Miami Beach. A $2 million home will get you a home. Uh-huh. In Utah, where they live, $2 million gets you basically part of the state. It's the biggest house I think I've ever seen. So, Susan, they say that the motive was money, was greed, was this $2 million. Simple question to you, and I've asked this before, why are people so greedy? I mean, to the point where they will kill and spend the rest of their lives in prison. And the irony right now, she's suing for money from behind bars, which you might never get to spend. But why are people so greedy?
Well, you know, it goes way back into there's potential for everybody to do something heinous given the right situation. So with her, for example, you know, when she's had this lifestyle, she sees this money that's in front of her, probably percolating on the fact that she could actually have this all her own. So that greed, that envy, that jealousy, always wanting that money. You think about why people do what they do. Almost every single one of these murders that we're covering, especially with Julie, we do these almost, well, like once or twice a week. We're talking about different cases. And it all boils down to a lot, usually it's hate, envy, greed. there's some sort of conflict within the family. They want to have what somebody else has. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it's the character of a human being. Their soul is dark. And when I think about that, I do believe, I'm a firm believer, there's good and evil. You know, Phil Waters and I, we talk about this. I think that there are some people that are just have an evil instinct, and that greed and jealousy and envy takes over, and they do horrible, heinous things because they're very selfish and self-centered, and all they're thinking about is their future and what they want to have, not knowing, and see, this is just me, I have just a very high moral compass. It's like, I'm not worried about this world. I'm worried about the one I'm going to after this, you know, like I want to make sure I'm going to do everything on the right side, because I don't want to be crossing that road and figure out I did it wrong. So anyway, that's just my own personal opinion. I just think that there's just people that are just evil, and they're dark, and they don't have a conscience. They don't have a moral compass. Everything is about them. They're very self-centered, and they're narcissistic. When you go through that person, does she have a borderline personality disorder? I just think, you know, when talking about $2 million, you're right. In my, I'm here in Orlando, and you know I have a very beautiful house here, but it's half of that, right? But in $2 million in Miami, it's probably what I have here, and I have a very beautiful house. And some people, and you think about the jurors that might be on that jury pool, they might be just everyday people, right? So a $2 million house is more than you would ever obtain in their entire life. And when you're thinking about civil damages, right, good luck with that one, because a lot of them can't relate.
By the way, I'm glad you brought up the great Detective Phil Waters. We have him on every Friday. I just emailed him. He has investigated over 400 homicides for the Houston PD. Julie, you need to get him on the show if you haven't already, but Phil's the best. He says there are three reasons, sex, drugs, or money. That's why people kill. And he says even the best person under the wrong circumstances can cross that line. He sometimes points to my own mother saying she could even do it, but I don't think it's
not your mom. Not your mom. But Phil's great. He comes on Court TV a lot. We enjoy him.
Phil's the best. So, Monica, to you, Eric Richin's family told investigators, and I'm curious from your point of view here, that he planned to tell his wife that they were not buying this $2 million mansion. On the same day, she was also told, Corey was told that she was being cut out of Eric's will. You talked about that will, Monica. This is a 22,000 square foot home. It's literally probably 10 times the size of my home, this thing. I'm obsessing about the size of this home. But anyway, I digress for a minute. What about the fact that, the family told her, or Eric told her specifically, that he wasn't going to buy this mansion? Also, she's being cut out of the will. By the way, she tried to attack, according to the sister, tried to attack her when she was told that. How deeply would you want to look into that? How troubling is that to you?
I wouldn't say you can't overcome it, but boy, would it be hard. The fact she'd already put the plan to murder the husband in place prior to February 14th of 2022, because he is suspected she had tried to poison him on a vacation to Greece prior. So this guy's spiny senses were already up and starting to, you know, he's starting to make changes in his life as far as his will, who's going to be the benefactor of his estate to protect the children. Even if he died in a car crash, he wanted his father and sister to be the benefactors, because he didn't want the wife to have any control over the finances, because he was worried that she was going to blow all of the resources and the children would be not destitute, but she just makes poor financial decisions. And he was already putting that stuff in place. So I think that's very important. And they also had a prenuptial agreement where she was only entitled to basically what she brought in, but anything prior and post income related, everybody was on their own. So she probably thought the only way to get her hands and onto some real money is to kill him. But the problem with that is that she's getting these life insurance policies behind his back, and he's being alerted to it. So everything she's trying to do is somewhat idiotic. And then she goes through with the plan to poison him successfully. And she's got the text messages with the drug dealer, and they find a check to the maid who's the conduit to the drug dealer. So I'm like, can I just get one smart client? Like, do you have to give me the stupidest one? Because these are all pretty stupid facts.
That's not even bad facts, stupid facts. But there's Monica Jordan. That's what I love about Monica Jordan. Not bad facts, stupid facts. By the way, I mean, I think for the purposes of this conversation, it's important to note that he came from a lot of money. She was working at Home Depot when they met each other. So, you know, that's a low wage salary. Here comes a guy that's pretty wealthy. Her antennas seem to have gone up then, perfectly fine, unless it ends the way it appears to have ended. What I love about Lunch Lives, you got Henchy Held, a friend of the show, coming to us from Israel. You got Kitty here. You got Sweden in the house. Of course, you got the Julie Grant fans flowing in right now. That's Dom's mom. And look at this. Oh, Julie Grant. The Julie Grant folks. Look at this. Julie Grant rocks. Can't disagree there.
Thanks, everybody. SDS Nation, so sweet.
We are the best. I will say that. We have the best guests and the best community. How about that? Cordies are close behind, though. I know that Cordies are very, very dedicated. The widow here, Corey, is charged to you, Julie, with first-degree aggravated murder and multiple counts of second-degree possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute. I mean, these are the most serious of charges. If you had to look into your crystal ball, you think there's any way they reach some sort of plea deal here? She sounds like she is pretty arrogant, if that is a proper word to use. It doesn't seem like she, she'll fold anytime soon. Do you see any sort of plea deal down the road?
That's a great question, Joel. Maybe, because the evidence against her is so bad and so damning, as we know. When we had that bond hearing that we televised, and we were all watching it because it was like a little mini trial. We're hearing witness testimony, and you're hearing piece of evidence after piece of evidence making her look so bad. You wonder, where is she going to possibly go? And then she files a civil suit so foolishly, just playing into the prosecution's legal theory that this was all about money. So to your question about plea agreement, here's what I think, if anything, could happen. This could become a capital case, right? Mm-hmm. Because she's charged with aggravated murder. Prosecutors could choose to seek the death penalty against her. Will they? Not sure. In any type of case like that, where a state office is going to be considering, okay, whether or not this is a capital case, we want to pursue it as such, they're going to, of course, factor in things like what the victims want. Who would it affect? Here we've got three young children who've already lost their dad. So one parent is gone, can never come back. Mom staying alive at least would give those boys a parent, albeit a parent in prison, but still a parent to potentially have a relationship with. To what degree, don't know. But I would think if they're going to do anything, maybe they use that as something to say, no, 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 we're not going to reduce this charge. No, 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 but we would choose not to pursue the ultimate punishment, which is reserved, as we know, for the most terrible offenders in our country. We can choose to hold off on that if you would plead, take responsibility, go to prison for the rest of your life. I could see them maybe doing that for her, but that's just me. We'll see. You never really know. I wish we were privy to those conversations, as you all know. They won't tell us anything ever in any case.
Well, I have talked to Greg Gordis, who represents the family, again, as a spokesperson, not as the attorney, but as a spokesperson, even though he is an attorney and a very successful one. He says, Utah does have the death penalty, but it's used very infrequently. He was kind of, he wasn't so sure they would get, turn this into a capital case, but who knows? Because there's growing attention and growing anger about what happened. But that's also a great point that she is the one remaining parent now. Susan, this is in your wheelhouse. What does Corey's body language tell you? Does she look worried of being found guilty at all, or does she seem confident? There was this hearing that Julie just mentioned. It was supposed to be a 15-minute hearing. It went on for like 4+ hours. It was basically a mini trial, kind of a la the Alec Murdoch trial. It appeared she was, quote unquote, sobbing. That's what some of the headlines said. But when he spoke to people inside the courtroom, they said there were no tears coming from those eyes, exactly like with Alec Murdoch. But Susan, if you did see that, any reaction to this comment here?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm writing a book right now, and one of them is those crocodile tears. And we see this, right, Julie? We've seen this even with Amber Heard. You know, she had these crocodile tears. But where are the tears? You know, tears come from emotion. It's inside, it's coming out. It's not coming from the nose. It should be coming from the eyes. So I think that most people will look at her and feel that she feels that she is a victim. And I think that she also appears pathetic. And I mean that not in a mean way, but because she feels that way. She's trying to put on the demeanor of being this very weak and frail person. And then she's got the few little crocodile tears, as you know, she's got this very collapsed body language. But overall, she's kind of emotionless other times. So when you're listening to her, and as the facts unfold, I am looking for congruent behaviors. When they're talking about something about has to do with her husband, how he died, the forensic evidence, I want to see how she's responding to that, because those are what we call stimuluses, right? So I look at what's the stimulus, and then how is she in a timed fashion, like within 7 seconds. So after a stimulus is entered in about specific evidence that should cause a physiological response, and she has nothing, she's not showing anything, and I'm tying that stimulus or those reactions to that stimulus, and I don't see anything, it's because it's void of it. So she's very detached. So that's how you read people. You tie in a stimulus, probative, an emotional response question. How do they perform? So, and all in all, I think that when you're looking at the jury is going to be analyzing her based on her responses, how she is reacting. We saw the same thing in the Amber Heard, and that's not a murder case. But on the other hand, juries are very perceptive, especially when it comes to court TV case and things like what you do here too, Joel, is that we are teaching the public to be hyper aware of demeanor and body language, because we're teaching them, all the body language experts, deception detection experts, we're pointing out clues for people to look at when they're analyzing people. And I think that's what they'll do. And then the other thing is too about that is most people generally get about 50% of it right, because they're not really good body language experts. But the point is what they take what they think and what they feel and they apply it, even if it's right or wrong. And that's very dangerous, because they're interpreting something they may not know how to interpret well.
And Susan, I just want to go back to something we talked about earlier, which is her outward appearance. When I first saw the photo of her, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. I mean, just because both she and he are, you know, just a good looking couple. And I don't know, I think there's always this expectation that a potential killer is going to look different, maybe. Do you think there is something with either nurture or just the nature, like you were talking about pure evil? I mean, what do you think could have precipitated this? Something in her past, maybe? Or do you believe she was just maybe born evil, this woman, despite not looking that way at all? I mean, she looks like she could be doing soap commercials, you know?
Yes. Well, first of all, I don't think that anybody is born evil. I think that things happen throughout a person's life. And when how narcissism develops is because they get away with stuff. If they get away with it, then they start feeling very empowered. Then they try other tactics. They get away with it. And I think that to answer your question is that she has a somewhat of a character flaw, and that has been developed over time. Maybe she feels that she can explain away why she deserves it. You know, she was betrayed, or that he didn't honor her, or whatever it was. So she felt entitlement. So I think the big one is entitlement with her. Mm. So maybe that came from her from before. I don't think that she actually came from money. I don't know. We have to ask Julie. But I don't think she actually came from money. But there, you know, it's really shocking to me, not just her, but others, to just feel like they're deserving. You have disrespected me. And they actually elevate themselves. There's a lot of self-deception going on. It's really very alarming, because it's something that I'm really hyper-focused on, is why people do what they do. Is this something that's always been in human nature, or is it because of other influences that are actually creating this outpouring of people, and especially women. We've never seen so many women committing so many heinous crimes as we have now. So there is a tie to past developmental stages and, you know, fragmentation and things that occur. But I think that a lot of them just think that they just deserve it.
Shout out to Belle Michelle from, again, my home state, Haddonfield, New Jersey. By the way, when I was in high school, we played Haddonfield, one of the best tennis teams in the state. And we would get killed every time. So there you go. Bringing back some memories. A question from Monica. Do you see the prosecution, as we were just talking about, going after the death penalty, or would this not qualify as a capital murder case? Monica, I think it was over 50 death penalty cases that you've worked. How does this one fit into that scheme, Monica?
I think this one falls right in line with being a death penalty case. You've got two aggravators right out of the gate, one being pecuniary gain. She killed him for money, or to have access to the money. And the other one is the administering of the lethal dose of the fentanyl. So those two aggravators could get her eligible for the death penalty. The problem with seeking death is that you have a much more difficult jury selection. And sometimes you have individual voir dire. Susan would know a lot about the jury consulting on death penalty cases. But the problem is that once you bring in far more experts in a death penalty case, and then if she is convicted and if she is, they recommend a death sentence, you then start an appellate process that will go on for years. And that, to me, always is a signal of so much more trauma to these children and the surviving family members. Because every few years, if you have newly discovered evidence, if you have juror misconduct, any of these things, it now opens the case back up for litigation. You're now back in the court system. These things never take place at good times. It's at a wedding, a funeral, a graduation. And guess what? We're all going back to court because mommy got a new hearing on, you know, a piece of paper that wasn't turned over. Those are all very important issues if you're trying to kill a defendant. But in cases like this, sometimes I think the safer way to go is to not seek death, because it just prevents the family from ever really moving on from these tragedies.
And we're seeing a lot of that play out right now with the Brian Koberger case.
Right.
I believe three of the four victims' families, I believe, are in favor of the death penalty. One was not. Either way, they're going to be dealing with that for a very long time. This question to Julie, why does it take 12 months not to convict? I don't think they mean that, but to arrest. Was there not hard enough evidence? The murder did occur well over a year ago, and she was only arrested a short time ago. Why that much time, Julie?
That's a great question. Because an investigation needed to be had, excuse me. She didn't admit to anything. She's in fact declaring her innocence. She's presumed innocent legally. And when he was found dead in their bedroom, according to her, and she places the 911 call, claims to have done CPR. There were a lot of things investigators had to sort through. I'll give you a couple quick examples. One, she said she did CPR. It was later discovered after speaking with the medical examiner who did the autopsy on Eric's body that she did not attempt CPR. When first responders got to the home, one of the questions they asked was, could this be a drug overdose? Does he use drugs? And guess what her answer was? No. No, he does not use drugs. Okay. And I thought about this and I thought, why in the world would she not say that? Because now we know now her defense is going to be, oh, he used some drugs. We know there were some communications from her in the jail saying that she would procure pills for him. I'll tell you why. This is my theory. Because every first responder police officer in America are equipped with naloxone or Narcan. Narcan's the brand name naloxone. It's a wonderful drug. It's the opioid reversal drug. You squirt it up the nose. It's foolproof. Like, you could do it blindfolded and, you know, with one hand tied behind your back, and you could save someone's life. It is such a wonderful drug. And when we had the start of the opioid epidemic, that was when there was so much of a push to have first responders carrying it and such. And so here, if she would have said drug overdose, I wonder if they would have right away given him some naloxone, perhaps I don't know if it was too far gone. I mean, she claimed that he was cold to the touch, but that was one of the things. Another thing they had to do that takes time, they had to seize all her devices, phones, computer, all that. A great example, she told investigators that when she had given him the Moscow Mule to celebrate, he drank it around 9 o'clock, went to bed. She goes in the room with one of the kids who was having a nightmare, wakes up at 3 a.m. and claims to have not had her phone with her, that it was plugged in her bedroom. Well, investigators of the forensic download could see that it was locked, unlocked, unlocked, locked multiple times during that window, which she claims not to have had it in hand and that the phone was moved. We learned a lot of that during the Murdoch trial, as you referenced, Joel, you know, how cell phones and the orientation can be determined. It's amazing. But all of that just takes time. It takes time to build an investigation, to get a warrant. Really and truly, I think they did it pretty swiftly. This is coming from a former prosecutor when his death was March of 2022. And she had time to write a book, go out there and promote it while they were gathering everything. I think these investigators did a fine job and didn't drag their feet.
Yeah, especially when you think about all the heat the Moscow Police Department was taking. And they saw that case. You know, he's not convicted yet, but
it's a great example.
Leave very quickly. I got to be careful with your words here. Mr. Papa Giorgio, this made me laugh, Corey Porins instead of Richens. And whether she's rich or poor might not matter if she's spending the rest of her life either in prison or faces the ultimate punishment. Laura Ferris here. The will, trust, and deeds are all present and accounted for. Law enforcement has them. I have not confirmed that, but we have a pretty smart audience here. So I will take Laura's word at this time. Monica, so getting to these lawsuits are kind of dueling lawsuits. According to a new $13 million lawsuit from Eric Richens' family, they allege civilly that Corey tried to profit from his passing. The suit, which was just filed in court, I believe late last week, the sister of Corey's late husband filed this suit saying that she, Corey Richens, funneled cash from the husband's bank accounts, diverted money intended to cover his taxes, and obtained a $250,000 fraudulent loan before his death back in March 2022. Again, you go in there and you investigate for the defense on behalf of the defense. If you were having a conversation with Sky Lazaro, her defense attorney right now, what would you be saying to her at this point?
How do we negotiate a plea?
You would.
How do we save her life? And I mean, there's really some problems. And one thing that Utah doesn't have is the slayer statute, I don't believe. And in Florida and several other states, you can't profit off the death of somebody you killed. So I can't kill somebody and then go write a book about it and then make and retain the proceeds. I don't think Utah has that. So that was one issue. That's how she was even able, you know, to be able to write this book and get all these proceeds, because if not, I don't think she would have been able to do that. By writing the book, it drew more attention to her, which I, you know, we talk about this on other segments about, you know, silence is golden. And the fact that she's given all these statements, and now, like Julie said, she's going to have to give all these depositions. You don't get the luxury of just pleading fifth in a civil deposition because you're getting charged and potentially getting a needle in your arm on at the end of this case. So these lawyers that have created these civil cases have created a bigger problem for the defense attorneys, because now not only do I have to deal with the inconsistencies with her original statement, oh, he doesn't do drugs, oh, I gave CPR, oh, he was cold to the touch, oh, I didn't unlock my phone. I say this all the time. You can't beat the science. Yeah. And so now that she's given all of these inconsistent statements, once you tell the lie, you then have to tell the next lie and then the next lie. And now we've got nothing but lies. So even if she wanted to, like, come clean and go, holy smokes, man, I'm caught. Look, you have zero credibility. So then by then the victim's family is so pissed off that you've done nothing but compound this problem and lie and lie and lie, that when you do finally come forward and say, you know, I just lost it and I killed him and I gave him a fentanyl drink, they are so far from center at that point. There's no going back.
It's interesting because all these. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Monica. Go ahead.
It just makes it almost. It almost. In the attempt to cover up this ridiculous, what I call a stupid crime, because this was just dumb how she did this. But in an attempt to cover it up and be so clever and so cute and so smart, she is digging a bigger hole for herself. And I just think that's really problematic. And if the lawyers that I work for, and you know some of the lawyers that I work for, we'd be shutting her down immediately with all of this trying to grab money in these lawsuits and all of this stuff. We'd be shutting her down and she wouldn't be saying another word, because every time she opens her mouth, we're getting our teeth kicked in.
Yeah, Tim Jansen would definitely not be having that at all. I want to come back to you in a couple minutes about what goes into a plea deal. But there's this question. By the way, shout out to my favorite name, Shaquille Oatmeal, Shaq Oatmeal. I'm convinced it is the real Shaq, even though he denies it. Susan, to you, Knightwood, what's involved with being a jury consultant? Fascinating job. How the heck did you get into that? And what do you do every day?
Okay, well, thank you for asking. I started out back when, remember, Andy Yates was retried. Okay, I was hired by JuryQuest. So I was a trial consultant that was ahead of the state of Florida, and I would train either prosecutors or defense lawyers how to use this AI technology tool in the courtroom during jury selection. It was all based on information that was in their juror questionnaire, a lot of their demographic factors, and based on social science data that's collected, we could identify specific characteristics of people that tend to be more pro-prosecution versus pro-defense. So I would identify who those dangerous jurors are and give the attorney a strike list depending on which side I was working for. So once you get beyond that part of it, then of course you got voir dire, we've got a death penalty case here. So kind of speaking to that, we're looking for high authoritarians. So at this point, we're now doing individual voir dire because we want to really whittle down about how they feel about the death penalty. So I use a score of 1 to 5. During that time where they're being asked specific questions about their thoughts and feelings about voir dire, I'm analyzing what they're saying, how they're saying it, and also their body language, what is it telling us? And then also telling the attorneys what other questions that you could ask so that we can drill down a little bit deeper about their thoughts, their belief systems, etc. So what I do on a regular basis is I'm analyzing videotapes with Phil Waters a lot. Phil and I've got two other gentlemen that work for me, statement analysis and voice stress analysis. We analyze everything from 911 calls to deposition tapes, to video analysis for police officers, for cases, you name it. Some of the high profile cases I've worked on is the Jeffrey Epstein case, Michael Jackson case, and also the Theranos case. I was hired in 2013 and I busted her back in 2013 and I said she doesn't believe in her own product, and she didn't believe in it because this is what she did, you guys. She puts her hand up to her neck and she goes, well, I have extreme belief that, and she's talking about her product. That's worrying concern. Right then I knew she didn't believe in her product. She knew it was going to fail. So anyway, that's what I do in jury selection and what I do here right behind my computer as we're talking right now.
Wow, that's
all the time. She keeps me busy.
right back to you, Susan, here. Lorna says she, Corey, had what most people would be happy with, a loving husband and gorgeous kids. Why wasn't that enough, Susan? Why wasn't it enough?
Well, first of all, women are not always, money goes over in powers and women want to feel secure more than they care about how good looking the guy is. I think that's statistically known. But why did she? Because she obviously wanted it all to herself. I don't know what, you know, without really knowing a lot about her background or not reading any of her psych evals, I don't know what was so fragmented in her life that actually brought her here. But one thing I do know is it didn't happen overnight. This is something that has been growing and building in her for many, many years. And so one of the things I want to speak to both the ladies is that all this information that we're hearing about being asked about different questions, she tends to isolate herself. So there's no other probable cause, no other person that could be pointed out. Has he ever done drugs? Has he ever done drugs before? Well, no. Well, that was a stupid question. I would have said, yeah, I've seen him. I've seen him take fentanyl a couple of times, but I didn't think he would take that much. But she, the more people talk, the more they hang themselves. So in any sort of investigative, interrogative interviewing or analysis, my job is to get them talking. Don't interrupt. The more they talk, they're going to give us really good clues, and they're going to tell us why they actually wanted to commit it in the first place. Hmm. I think Gary is buried in somewhere in her depositions.
Catherine Regier, who watches us from Hawaii, what not Carm? Carm is exempt from evil. I'll give you that. Carm is only, she'll only yell at me. That's as evil as she gets. Shelly says, that's where I know her from, Court TV. You are watching Julie Grant, Court TV anchor right here. And speaking of Julie Grant, so Eric's estate is seeking millions of dollars in damages now from Corey Richens for alleged financial wrongdoing. Katie Richens, who's been the brave sister of Eric, kind of the face and voice of the family, she also accuses Corey Richens of stealing other estate property. When I read this, I was like, shaking my head, at least $225,000 in cash, furniture from the theater room, an electric motorcycle, a flatbed trailer, off-road vehicles, ATVs, in total items estimated to be worth at least $300,000. I mean, I don't know how else to say this. What the hell's going on here? Like, she's stealing this right stuff on top of everything else. I mean, how much does this hurt the case?
Right, Joel, it does. It's so great for the state. I mean, it's just, so she's a financial disaster. So, and I think that's what's really a key to understanding this case. Because at first, when I looked at it, I'm like, what's going on? You have this couple and they're very, very wealthy. Eric is the wealthy one. As you pointed out, so prior to marrying him, she had a job at Home Depot, but that wasn't her dream job. Her dream was to buy these expensive homes that she couldn't afford, you know, fix them up a little bit, flip them, make a profit, and be wildly successful. And so he helped her begin that dream business venture that she failed at. She failed miserably. And it was getting so bad that 2 years before Eric was found dead, he went and he started putting things in his sister's name. He made his sister the executor of his estate, executor of the will. He created a trust and made sure his sister would be the one administering the funds to the three kids because Corey was such a financial mess. And the tension was building. There was a property that she really wanted to buy or sell. Something was at issue around the time of the homicide, and they were fighting about it. So things were kind of building, escalating. And so knowing that she was such a wreck previously really helps the state get to the point where he's suddenly dead. You know, this healthy 30-something year old, you know, father with this great stone masonry business was what he had long before he ever met her, but she was bleeding him. And so when he finally said, no, 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 you're not going to touch these funds. And oh, by the way, I don't trust you with our funds. And there was a prenup in place so that it wasn't like, you know, they could get divorced and she could attack the money. No, she had nowhere to go. But homicide is the state's theory. As sick and sinister as that is, that's the allegation.
Julie, how come these people across the board, the biggest deterrent for me is prison. I would not do very well in prison. Don't ever want to go to prison.
I hear you.
As a reporter, I avoided jailhouse interviews. I just don't want to be in there. Why don't people think about that, do you think?
Yeah, why don't they think? You know what I think, Joel? I think they think they won't get caught. And I had to laugh when all her searches were revealed. Remember, she did all those different like searches on her phone. You know, if somebody is poison, what does it go down on the death certificate? Can cops force you to do a lie detector? You know, it was just a treasure trove of stupid searches that she did. And one of them was about like, what prisons do rich people go to? And I'm thinking, oh my, Oh my, none of them are all that great, well, honey. You know,
I guess she thought she might be going there because she was checking them out. I got news for her. None of them are too good. I'll take a Motel 6 over the best of prisons any day. Annika, back to you, because you mentioned it. I asked you what would you be saying to Sky Lazaro right now, and you said a plea deal. Kind of pull back the curtain, because most of us, including myself, don't really know what goes on. I mean, if you're sitting behind a closed door with Sky Lazaro, how does that process play out if you're looking for a plea deal? I mean, obviously you have to go to the defendant, right? You have to try to convince Corey, but how does it all work?
Well, I think it's a really delicate dance. You got to have a really talented trial lawyer that they know is not terrified to go to trial. I mean, all you got to do is beat the government a couple of times and they know, oh, this, you know, this lawyer's no joke. So it really depends on who she hired. And I don't know her defense attorney. I'm certain she's probably very good. So there's always that door open for negotiations. The issue what I was talking about earlier is when the defendant or the client is continuing to make stupid statements, get involved in civil litigation over money. I mean, nothing tells me you're grieving about the death of your husband, like trying to sue for more money. I mean, that's like the most disingenuous thing you can do when you're saying, oh my God, I loved him. I didn't kill him. Can I have a little more money? I mean, that's just like, are you really trying to piss the family off? Because,
but again, if I was her, and I apologize for interrupting because I try not to, but if I was her, the last thing on earth I'd be thinking about is money. I'm sitting in jail, possibly facing life in prison. I mean, I guess that's more of a question for Susan, maybe. But what the hell is she thinking? I mean, shouldn't she be worrying about her defense right now, Monica?
I would be. I mean, spending more money fighting over money is a waste of resources. I would be pulling all of my resources for my defense team. And I would be hiring experts, and I would be combating every one of those, the credibility of all of those other witnesses. I mean, there's, even when I say you can't beat the science, that doesn't mean you can't test what the government is claiming the science says. And that's where I would be spending the resources. But if you think I'm going to pay somebody $300 an hour to fight over the estate of some money, that is a waste of resources, in my opinion. And that is not where I'd be directing. If I was on that team, that is not where I would be directing or helping direct the client where their resources and their priorities should be. Because I can promise you, she can win all the money in the world. The more money you have in your canteen, the more they take out. So Eric's family will make sure those boys are taken care of. So I don't even think she can use the argument that this money is going to protect the children. So I just feel like where my priority would be is defending the facts, defending the evidence. She has painted herself in a corner, and I agree with Susan and Julie completely. And that is the circumstances she has put herself in with the IRS and all of these other financial crises, the house of cards came down, and this was her last attempt. Unfortunately, she had already seen the writing on the wall, and this was coming down, and she tried to kill him 2 months earlier. Hmm. Or at least that's what he believed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was Valentine's Day. Was it Valentine's Day? Yeah.
Yeah, you're correct, Joel. Yep. And wow, they corroborated the purchase of the pills on February 11th through the dealer who's talking, who's a cooperating witness. So just a couple of days before the $900 sale of 15 to 30 fentanyl pills.
Did
street
I
fentanyl.
Do not I remember this? Was it, is a dealer a woman?
Yes,
it is.
Well, actually, you know what? I shouldn't say. I don't know.
I think the housekeeper is the conduit to the person that procured the illegal narcotics.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a question about that, Monica, and you may know. Because at first, when I was reading it, I'm like, is it the same person? Is she trying to say she knew CL is how they're listed in the affidavit of probable cause? I'm like, are they pretending to be the housekeeper, you know, to justify the check that you mentioned earlier, you know, why is money being left like on the porch of these different homes that she was flipping or living in, you know, or they say,
well, I think she thinks this is my opinion, is that Corey's trying to be cover her tracks, and I'm leaving checks for the maid. So that's to clean the house and do the laundry. That's not for dope. Yeah. But the problem is they found CL, the alleged housekeeper, who then turned them on to the person that she actually procured the drugs with. So they were able to try and, you know, verify what CL was saying. And so they listed as acquaintance one and acquaintance two in the probable cause, because they don't want the whole world to know who these potential witnesses are, because so they're not contaminated or tampered with or, you know, touched before they give a statement before a grand jury or actual trial testimony.
Susan, I always tell Phil Waters, I cannot imagine if I was your child with Phil Waters interrogating you. But then on the flip side, imagine if Monica Jordan was your mother and she's this investigator. That's a tough life for a kid. That's a very tough life. Tara Wells says, Susan, this is for you. I find her need for so much money and fame interesting. She seems to be so plain. Why did she need millions when he was providing a very comfortable life? Someone right before this posted that some people are just always envious. I mean, we talked about this already, but what do you think? Is it really, at the end of the day, a money problem? People say money is the root of all evil, or was it, you know, narcissism or these other kind of labels that are thrown around? What do you believe?
Well, I don't think money is the root of it. I think that is a byproduct of something that in her character that is lacking. I think that there is some sort of psychological profile. And again, she's probably borderline. She's whatever it was in her life that she doesn't feel like she was seen, right? Because doesn't feel validated, doesn't feel important, and envy and greed. So it's multifaceted. It's not just one thing. You know, when you think about why she did what she did, she gave you clues all the way through. All the way through from the very beginning, when she was stealing money and money was moving around. All these were off her baseline. I'd like to know, and it's really interesting, at what point did she fall off? Where was the beginning of when things started to shift? That's what I want to know, what was going on in her life at that time, because that would give you insight what set this trajectory on this other course. We don't know what she's watching. We don't know what she's reading. We don't know who she might be comparing herself to. She may have idols or friends that are very wealthy, or maybe it was another woman that was single that was wealthy and she thought that maybe she could be her. I don't know. There's so many different reasons why we just don't have enough to really make any sort of definitive, you know, diagnosis, so to speak, why she did what she did.
As a son of a psychiatrist, and my mother is a licensed therapist, I am always so interested in that. Like, you go back to the Lori Vallow case, and now her friends are trying to figure out when did she, like, kind of fall off that cliff. But it's interesting to hear you say it, because I'm sure you can go back in time and, you know, if you're graphing it out, the course of life, you could probably pinpoint, you know, where did she really start to kind of de-escalate and fall apart. Papa Bear watches the show all the time from Moscow, Idaho, a place that is near and dear to our hearts. So shout out. Always a special shout out to Papa Bear. You got Frank. I'm not going to even attempt to say his last name, even though I am from Jersey. That's me, a big time Julie Grant fan. I'll try it. Smiraglinolo or something close to that. Anyway, Julie, to you. So this lawsuit goes on, and there's a little bit more to cover, and then we'll call it a Wednesday. But the lawsuit claims that Corey Richens, quote unquote, misappropriates Eric's likeness and identity. This is in the children's book on grief that she authored in the wake of her husband's death. That's part of this whole lawsuit. The complaint also alleges that she abused her husband's personal identity as she sold and promoted her book both on Amazon and, this is hard to believe, on KTVX Channel 4's Good Things Utah, Julie, you and I both worked in local news. I'm right. So glad I was not the anchor interviewing her. She killed me, dumbass, after the fact. It says in the suit that Katie Richens, the sister of Eric, is further entitled to a permanent injunction forever barring Corey from disseminating, selling, or reproducing the book. What about this book? I haven't even gone on Amazon. Do you know, can you still buy it at this point?
I don't think you can. We've tried to find it, and I think it got pulled up for reasons, you know, we all know. And if you look at the cover of it, and the artwork, you can still Google and find it. It's it looks like a picture of Dad, like smiling, you know, from the clouds of heaven, looking at the kids, and are you with me? And to your point, Joel, about, you know, the anchors on the local station, they're absolutely going to have, you know, great investigators working for the prosecution, you know, someone like Monica, who's going to be talking to them saying, hey, what did she say to you prior to that interview? Did she tell you not to ask her how Eric died? Because when you watch the interview, that's the big missing question. She's sitting there, yeah, my husband suddenly passed away. Yeah, he was only 33. Yeah, it's so sad. I wrote the book to help my kids, blah, 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 blah. How did he die? What happened to him? They never touch it. And so I would love to know, you know, obviously the state's going to go there. They're going to ask, hey, what did you do in the pre-interview? What was said? Did she say, I can't answer this? Because the book is almost like I don't want to call it an alibi, because alibi, you know, it's something that where somebody can say, hey, I wasn't there because I was here at the time. But it's almost like a manufactured after the fact alibi, you know, where, oh, I'm so sad and I'm devastated. I feel so bad for my three kids. I'm going to write this book. And I love that the lawyers are going after her for this. I love that the Richens lawyers, you know, and Katie is leading that charge with Amy, the other sister who she attacked when she was going in the gun safe and Amy caught her. They are trying to say, you know, not only did you kill our brother allegedly, but now you're trying to look like the hero, use his image and likeness to make this book get off the ground. No, not going to fly. So we noticed that it's really hard to find. If I find one, I'll let you know, Joel.
And Julie, Shaquille O'Neal is asking, do we know when the trial is set for and is it going to be televised? I believe this one will be televised. Do you know?
Yes. So we don't have a date yet. What they're doing is still like going date by date. Like she'll have another status hearing. She's entitled to a preliminary hearing as well. So it's going to be a long way off, but we don't, sometimes courts will set a projected date way off in the future. To my knowledge, there isn't one yet. But as far as we know, the camera should be allowed in. Utah's a state where they allow our cameras. We were in for the detention hearing. We did the Gwyneth Paltrow ski crash case in Utah not too long ago. The courts are very friendly with cameras there. So if we're allowed, Court TV will definitely put them there, Joel.
And that's where you will watch it, Court TV. Anna saying hello from Poland, which I love. KCL saying hello from Salt Lake City, getting her exercise in, which I already hit the gym today. I'm trying to get back in shape. It's taken a while. Let's see here. Dom's mom says, Monica, I can't see her taking a plea deal. She'd have to admit guilt. The other thing that I'm curious about, Monica, when you go and speak to these people, I know that the defense attorney is probably doing most of the talking, but how would you approach someone like Corey Richens when you're trying to rationalize with her, considering she doesn't seem to be a very rational human being and maybe a little dumb, too? I don't know.
First, to go back to Julie, when you're talking about the alibi, we affectionately, those post-created alibis, we affectionately refer to them as alalies. But in a case of Ms. Richens, the initial client intake, when you're really talking about the facts of the case, I don't like to get into the actual facts of the case until they've read a lot of their material and discovery. Because I don't want to put them in a position right out of the gate that they're going to lie to me. Mm. Because that, I no longer have a good foundation of them trusting me when I tell them, hey, listen, man, we're in a really bad spot and you are going down. So if I initially start off by going, hey, tell me what happened, I'm asking them to not be truthful. So that's a terrible way to start a relationship. I don't know if Susan agrees with that or not, but that's the way I do it. And then after we develop a little bit of a relationship and we're talking about historical and social history and lifetime experiences, then I start getting a better understanding of what I'm dealing with. So if I'm dealing with somebody that has a personality disorder or is narcissistic or is a concrete thinker or is just going to BS me, at least I have a little better lay of the land. Because if they initially just started lying to the cops, why would I think they're going to, you know, sometimes people are just going to take that lie all the way to the grave. Other times they're going to be like, oh man, I'm screwed. I better see what's in my best interest. So when you talk about how I would start my relationship or start an interview with Ms. Richens, it would be just a conversation. Uh-huh. You know, when we talk about some of these serial killers and we talk about these people that commit murders, we touched on this briefly in the beginning, and that is we have this image in our head that they're all monsters and they look like some cyclops and, you know, it's the boogeyman. When they come out and they're beautiful and they're wearing, you know, they're dressed like us and they're driving vehicles like us, we're like, holy smokes, this could be me. That's where the misconception is. And that's why when I sit down and I have a conversation with them, it's not always just about the case. It's just about, hey, let's just talk about what's going on.
Susan, okay. What about that approach, Susan?
Well, first of all, I'm not the attorney, so I'm not asking those questions. You know, I've been in the jail many times with the attorneys as they're preparing them for trial and I've learned a lot through the case about the case and about the client during that time. But the most important thing, and to kind of hitchhike off what she just said, is that you really want to use what we call empathy-based listening. And empathy-based listening is not having compassion for the person, but to understanding how they got where they're at and let them walk through their life without any sort of preconceived bias. And once you bias them, like what you were just talking about, all of the trust is going to go outside the window. So you use what we call minimizing techniques. You know, I'm sure there was a very good reason. I'm sure that there's stuff that happened in your life that you didn't expect to have happen. I'm sure your life isn't what you expected it to be, even though you were married to someone that had lots of money. I'm sure that there were lots of other things, the reason that may have brought you to this place, but you never accuse. So we found that in any sort, and this is not an investigative, interrogative, as an attorney, this is not what you're doing, or as a trial consultant, you're letting them talk, you're trying to understand what are some of the strengths and weaknesses of their case, and you build on their strengths. So when I'm working with a client, I want to bring out all the good stuff about them. I want to pick out things that they're known for, that their people admire them about, you know, maybe, you know, their scholastic ability, or maybe how well she took care of her kids. I'm going to instruct the attorneys to start to build on that. So, and not even focus on the other, and don't have her take the stand, because she'll never make it through it. There's no way. She'll impeach herself. And the other thing is too, is that it's really important for attorneys to have a good gut feeling about it, because the last thing an attorney wants to do is to be there in the courtroom and their client gets impeached right before them. There's nothing more embarrassing and humiliating than that. It's like you don't even know your own client. So part of what I teach is how to teach attorneys how to vet their clients. And that's really important too, because you don't want to go in there and be embarrassed.
It is, it's kind of an art form. CJ Drake here for you, Julie. I heard that her children had life insurance policies. How is this legal and under what normal situation is this acceptable? Followed by this comment, who the F gets life insurance on your babies? Are you familiar with this? Can you speak to this?
That's interesting. You know, I wish I knew with certainty. I have not heard anything about the children. What I do know, and police are using this fact, that unbeknownst to Eric Richens, Corey Richens took out multiple life insurance policies on him. So that was one of the very telling facts to law enforcement, that a couple years prior to his death, she's doing this. She's taking out this money on him. Or why? Why wouldn't you tell your spouse unless it's for some sinister purpose? And we know that she did, in fact, collect. We know it was $1.8 million instantly that she got upon his death because of one of those policies. And so I'd be happy to look into that. Thank you for those questions about the kids. I don't know. I mean, you can have them on children. But I don't know that that will even come into play here. I'm not so sure, because thank God the children are all okay. They're all unharmed.
Monica, have you come across that, life insurance policies on young children?
I know in Florida you can get a life insurance policy on a child, but I don't know in Utah.
Yeah, it's weird. It would never cross my mind. I don't know. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, you think about it, I've got two kids and I have a granddaughter. Why would I take out an insurance policy? I mean, that just is like weird. Like, I wouldn't want to profit off of losing someone that I love so much.
It's almost like willing it too. It just kind of creeps me out. I didn't know. I never heard of it. I guess I haven't heard of a lot. But you know what? I'm gonna ask my mom at 84 if she's heard of it. I'm finishing up. She's gonna yell at me when she hears this. But I am turning in a manuscript. It's a book about her and life advice from her that will be out next Father's Day. Turning it in next week. And with the same title as the podcast, and I'm getting to the final chapter, and my mom started yelling at me. She's like, "Why the hell are you writing a book about me? I don't know anything. It's a myth that people who are 84 know stuff." So I just ruined the ending of the book, but that's it. Sweet Crazy says, "It's hard enough getting a good man, but oh no, Corey, she had to get rid of one. So one less good man on planet Earth." We're going to finish it up with this and then call it a day, but one of the commenters said there were actually, and maybe Julie, you know this, but I do not, but I know 3 weeks prior to this lawsuit from Eric Richin's family, Corey herself, as we've been talking about, filed her own civil lawsuit seeking, I think, $2 million, about half the equity in the home and more, but about $2 million in proceeds from the sale of Eric's share of a stonemasonry business and half the equity in the couple's $1.9 million home. Someone said this is the third civil lawsuit that she's filed. But again, Julie, we've talked about it. Just kind of laying out the numbers here. $1.9 million, she wants half of that, and half of the proceeds from this $2 million stonemasonry business that she had nothing to do with, essentially, other than being married to him. Again, how does this hurt the criminal case, knowing she's asking for this in civil court?
It hurts her because she needs money, and the state already knows she needs money. And they allege that, you know, even before she filed these suits, but so foolishly, it's like she confirms their legal theory about why she allegedly did the homicide, because she was broke, in a world of trouble. He was no longer wanting to support her business that she was failing at. I mean, she was failing. She was losing money, and it really wasn't her money to lose. It was his money. He's the rich one. He was the successful entrepreneur with this flourishing business. It was only because of marrying him that she could even have those funds to try to flip these homes. And so by her firing the first shot too, with the first lawsuit that his family just, you know, basically answered back with theirs, she opened herself up to a world of trouble, and now she's exposing herself to even more questioning, answers she's going to have to come up with. And it's like the state ought to thank her, give her a big hug and a kiss for helping them solidify their legal theory in the homicide case.
For those who do not know, she is a frequent guest on the show, Susan Constantine. She's one of the nation's leading jury consultants. She's also a body language and communication expert and owner of the Human Behavior Lab. You see her all over television, including Encore TV with Julie Grant. I'm going to get your final thoughts, Susan. But first, Teresa from Ireland. A lot of people have questioned why Eric stayed when he knew his life was at risk. But isn't that just the same as staying in an abusive relationship and finding it hard to leave? I guess if you flipped it, I think is what she's getting at. If, you know, Eric was a woman and was killed by her male, by the husband, you know, most people aren't going to fault the woman. You know, it's hard to leave a relationship. Isn't it the same for a male or no, Susan, to get out of a relationship?
Well, I think it's easier for a woman to get out of a relationship than it is for a guy, because I think that guys are naturally very, you know, they don't want to feel like they're a failure. They want to feel like they've always been successful in everything that they do. Women, on the other hand, I think that, you know, they think that there's more fish in the sea. There's something always better out there. But I don't know that for a fact. But I do want to bring one point, if I could ask, answer this, is that, and this is for anyone that is out there, anytime you start to see any changes in behavior, anything that is off from a person's baseline, you start seeing unusual activity, there's always a reason why. Don't ignore it. Always listen to it.
Very well said. Susan, before I let you go, Knightwood, where will the children end up? Tragic. We don't know, I guess, where they're going to end up. But bigger picture, more macro, what's this going to do to the kids? That this is going to stay with them the rest of their lives and their young little boys.
Yeah, well, gosh, imagine their legacy here. You know, what are they going to tell all of their future boyfriends, their husband, their wives? I mean, these kids are going to be dealing with trauma for their entire life. This is not something they're going to get over, you know, after a couple of years. I think that they'll learn to be able to survive, but it will absolutely change who they are. And hopefully that they're going to get the right help and support system to get them through. And at least if there's anything good about it, they're still young.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Susan Constantine. Monica Jordan kind of huddled down in that chair of hers wearing a dueling green to my green. She is the president of Jordan Research and Consulting. She is one of the country's most sought after private investigators. You don't know a lot of people that have handled more than 50 death penalty cases, but now you know Monica Jordan. By the way, I'm not going to say exactly where or who, but her husband is a big badass, big time law enforcement officer, but you know that Monica runs that house and not him. So, Monica, your final thoughts on this is she up, you know what, creek without a paddle. Corey Richens here.
I think they will be able to present a defense. I think they're going to face some extreme challenges. The bigger issue to me is, like what Susan said, these children. If they are allowed to visit their mother in prison, that is terribly traumatic. They're faced with the fact that if their mother continues to say, I didn't kill him, I didn't kill him, I didn't kill him, they now are torn between wanting to believe their mother and also saddled with this extreme guilt from their father's side of the family that's saying, your mama killed your dad. Mm-hmm. So it is such a blender to put these small children in. And then if you do add the eligibility for death sentence, to think that your mother is going to be executed for the death of your father, that's a big load to carry. And I agree with Susan, they're young and they can move past this, but holy smokes, they're going to have to carry this thing forever. And that is heartbreaking to me.
Frank says, I'm still watching and I subscribe now as well, Julie. So look at that. Julie is getting me a subscriber. I now owe her a drink one day. She got me.
Oh, you don't owe me anything. Thanks for having me. I'd love to have you on the show too. You and Monica sometime. We'll have to come on TV.
I would love to. You know, I go on Vinny's show with my mom. It's kind of hilarious.
It's awesome. Yeah, your mom is adorable.
Yeah, but
please,
we would
give her my love.
Yeah, we will. I would love to do that. Look at Debbie Fox, Monica Jordan. Love these guests. Monica, you are my true hero. How about that?
Yeah, thank you.
Everyone knows her, but for those who don't, her name is Julie Grant. She is a Court TV anchor and award-winning journalist. On top of that, she's a licensed attorney, a former prosecutor, and a trial expert. Her Court TV colleagues call her the professor, and it's not because of the glasses, but you just found out why. She knows a lot of all the nuances of these cases, and you can now watch her at 8 a.m. on Court TV, Monday to Friday, so check her out.
Julie,
what are you guys covering right now? What's the big story? It's kind of a slow period during the summer, but what are you guys, what are people interested in at this time?
Yeah, we have a few really biggies cooking, and so today we're in Texas with the former Border Patrol agent supervisor accused of murdering his mistress and their love child. So that one's a big death penalty case going on. We're there. We're also gearing up for a cold case in Arizona, the Alyssa Turney case. Her sister went on TikTok, did a lot of videos and drummed up interest. Her stepfather is being accused of her homicide, which was over 20 years ago. The body hasn't been found. That one starts tomorrow in Arizona. Also a big hearing in Florida with the ballerina case, Ashley Benefield, we're calling it the Black Swan murder trial, you know, from that ballerina movie, Black Swan, where she is accused of murdering her husband, but she's saying it was in self-defense. So tomorrow there's going to be a Stand Your Ground hearing in Florida on that one. So we'll be live on that one as well. And all the other cases that I'm sure you're following as well, the Ohio dad, you know, who's said to have murdered his three kids execution style. We're all over that one. He was in court today, and other ones like that that are still early on. You know,
is that a capital case, the Ohio one?
Great question. So unofficially, yes, the prosecutor spoke out to the media and said that he intends to seek the death penalty.
If that's not.
But the notice hasn't been filed yet.
Yeah. If that's right. not a capital case, then there should never be a capital case. Yeah. That is one of the... Yeah, I mean, I have a little boy and two girls. That was one of the worst stories in recent memory. One story, I'm going to pitch a story to Julie Grant live on SBS right now. We did it last night. It's the Ellen Greenberg case out of Philadelphia. If you don't know about it, she was found dead. Monica, pay attention, and Susan, because I'm going to bring you guys all on to discuss this. I'm going to make you do your homework. She was found dead in 2011. She was engaged. Ellen was engaged to a guy named Sam Goldberg. Philadelphia. She was an elementary school teacher. She was found dead. She had 20 stab wounds, 10 to the front, 10 to the back, including the back of her neck. An independent autopsy showed that two of the stab wounds happened after she was already dead. It's hard to stab yourself when you're dead, and it was ruled a suicide. Lo and behold, Sam Goldberg's family are very powerful attorneys in the city of Philadelphia and judges. And this case has been swept under the carpet. And Josh and Sandy Greenberg, Julie, and I'm happy to share and have you bring them on Court TV.
Thanks, Joel.
They are looking for justice. And I've got people tweeting and retweeting and tweeting and retweeting. The mayor of Philadelphia has it in his power to reopen this case right now. The family has personally spent over $500,000. When you read about the details of this case, it's given me the goosebumps. Unthinkable is the worst cliche in news, but it's unthinkable. It is a travesty of justice. We don't necessarily know exactly who the killer might be, but she was definitely, it was definitely not self-inflicted. That is a consensus across the board. But I'd love for you guys to cover that on Court TV. I think they're also about to make a big documentary about it. So it would be good timing, and I'm happy to share.
I would love to talk about that. But thank you. You know, and in the morning at 8 a.m., we get some time to talk about these cases, as Susan knows, before court usually starts around 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. So this would be a good one, you know, to have her parents on. And Joel, if you want to come on the day we do, you're so knowledgeable about it. You know, we can drum up some discussion. Absolutely.
100%. We will definitely talk offline. I just want to let STS know, quick programming note, tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Julie has done this. We have not. We are morphing. This is horrible. Morphing into the Morphew. Suzanne, I just made that up right now. We're doing the Suzanne Morphew case tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Eastern time. She is a missing Colorado mom. The state believes now that they have an inkling as to where her body might be located. So we're going to examine that. We have one of the people that was just featured on 48 Hours coming on tomorrow night. She is a law professor. That'll be a fascinating show. And then Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern time, it's Susan Constantine's best friend, Phil Waters, with Scott Duffy. Great, Scott. It's time for your true crime, Phil, with Phil Waters. Get the pun. That is Friday at 5 p.m. Until then, love you, America. That's my homage to Geraldo, by the way. Love you, Florida. That's where we three are, and love you, Atlanta, Georgia, and everywhere in between.